Hello, theater lovers. It's me, Bryn. This episode will be all about Dear Galileo by Claire Willett. I love this play because it's one of those plays out there that combines science and art in a very, like, beautiful and eloquent way. Here is normally where I would give some announcements, but in case you can't hear it in my voice, I'm very sick this week, so there will be no announcements today, but if any of y'all have any digital theater things going up or things you've heard about or seen that you think I should talk about, please email me or DM me on Instagram, and I will hopefully be able to talk about them in the announcements of next episode. So, without further ado, let's get into the world of Dear Galileo by Claire Willett. Portland native Claire Willett is a playwright, novelist, former Catholic youth minister, and nonprofit grant writer. She is a past recipient of the Oregon Literary Fellowship for Drama, has received creative project grants from the Regional Arts and Culture Council and the Oregon Arts Commission, was a founding artist of Portland's Fertile Ground Festival of New Work, for which she wrote 5 plays and 2 librettos, and spent 6 years as a company member of the award-winning Portland-based writers collective, Playwrights West. She has a BA in theater from Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington, is a graduate of the Paul A. Kaplan Theater Management Program at Manhattan Theater Club in New York City, and resides in her hometown of Portland, Oregon. Her play, Dear Galileo, was produced in Portland in 2015 by Playwrights West and Coho Productions, where it was a Drammy Award finalist for Best Original Script, and has been developed at the Sheen Center for Thought and Culture and the Lark Play Development Center in New York City, Pasadena Playhouse in Pasadena, California, En Route Theater Company in Seattle, Washington, and Artists Repertory Theater in Portland, Oregon. Here is a short summary of Dear Galileo from New Play Exchange. 3 women in 3 different times wrestle with their identity, the conflict between science and religion, and what it means to be their father's daughters. In Renaissance Italy, Celeste Galilei lives under house arrest with her elderly father, Galileo, the disgraced astronomer who was imprisoned for defying the Pope, but yearns to secretly publish one last book. In a small town in Texas, creationist author and TV pundit Robert Snow is at a loss when his 10-year-old daughter Haley's newfound passion for science begins to pull her away from the biblical teachings of her upbringing. And in Swift Trail Junction, Arizona, home of the Vatican Observatory's U.S. outpost, pregnant New York sculptor Cassie Willows arrives to find that her estranged father, world-renowned astrophysicist Jasper Willows, has gone missing. As the 3 stories move towards their point of convergence, the destinies of each become inextricably bound with the others, linked through time by love, family, grief, faith, the search for identity, and the wonder of the stars. Did this show make me cry? Absolutely. Was this in part because the first play that I ever wrote had a main character who made attempts to understand a personal tragedy through astrophysics? Probably. But I believe this show is powerful for other reasons, mostly in its exploration of parent-child dynamics, the relationship between science and spirituality, and just the overall, like, interconnectedness of all living beings. I'll discuss that more in the discussion section. To really understand all of this, we're going to discuss Galileo's contribution to science, the Vatican's involvement in astrophysics and astronomy, and the very basic talking points of both creationists and evolutionists? I don't know that that's the word, but evolutionists. Yeah, and that one might get a little bit dicey, but like usual, I'm going to stay as unbiased as possible until the end of the section, and then you might hear a little bit of my opinion, and you can probably already guess what that is, but anyways. Galileo. Galileo wasn't just an astronomer, he was also an engineer, an inventor, and physicist. Not to be confused with Isaac Newton and the Apple incident, which I almost did before reading this play. Oops. Galileo is known for discovering a lot of stuff, such as the theory of tides, and essentially developing the scientific method. But the most important thing to know about him for this play is that he was one of the first champions of Copernican heliocentrism. Copernican heliocentrism is just the theory, well, now known fact, that the Earth rotates daily and revolves around the sun. Galileo got in a lot of trouble for writing about and supporting this idea. Who did he get in trouble with? The Catholic Church, of course. Did Galileo sorta insult the Pope directly in his book, Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems, in which he pretty openly supported Copernican heliocentrism? Yeah, oh, totally, yes. Was he right, though? Yeah, absolutely. However, the Pope and the Church were, they were pretty mad. And they tried him for heresy. They forced him to recant most of his opinions, which are now known facts, that he stated in his book, and put him under house arrest for the rest of his life. He didn't just sit and do nothing in his house until he died of old age, though. He actually wrote his last book, Two New Sciences, which summarized multiple different things he had worked on earlier in his life. In the play, one of his illegitimate daughters helps him with this book. I had trouble finding any sources to support this historically, though his daughter Maria Celeste, which was like her nun name, because she was a nun, was very close to him, and the convent in which she lived was also very close to the house in which Galileo was under house arrest at the end of his life. So, based on all that information and her name, we can probably guess that the character Celeste is most likely based on her. So now, what about the Vatican and astronomy? How does the seat of Catholicism get involved in science at all? Especially after literally trying someone for heresy for putting forth their scientific theories. Well, Galileo is actually the biggest reason, or one of the bigger reasons, that the Vatican got involved in science at all. I know, it seems so weird that the seat of Catholicism, who imprisoned him for his theories, would fund astrophysics and astronomy research specifically. I bet you can guess from what we've just discussed that the Vatican funded the Vatican Observatory and employed all Jesuit scientists as a strange sort of apology. It is stated on museumsecrets.tv, I don't know how reliable that is, but it seemed vaguely reliable, that the Pope did this in an attempt to heal the rift between science and theology. Did it do that? I think a lot of people would probably say no, but I guess it's a start. The exact telescope mentioned in the play, the Vatican Advanced Technology Telescope, or VAT, is a real telescope funded by the Vatican in Arizona, USA. VAT is a part of the Mount Graham International Observatory, which is owned and operated by the Vatican Observatory, and its first light, or its first use, was in 1993. All of the characters in this play, except for Galileo and Celeste, by the way, are not real people who were involved in that or any other situations present in the play. I just thought I'd put that in there, since that and Galileo and Celeste are all real. From what I can tell, the rest of the characters, not real. Okay. So now onto the whole creationism thing, since that is a large part of the conflict between one of the, like, thirds of the play. I guess you should explain that a little more. The summary kind of did it, but I'll explain it again. The play is sort of divided into time periods. Like, there are the Galileo and Celeste scenes, which are in, like, Renaissance Italy. Gabriel and Cassie scenes, which are in Arizona, you know, before VAT is up and running, so in, like, the 90s. And then there are Robert and his daughter Haley scenes, which are in, like, the early 2000s. This is the main conflict between Robert and Haley, who's 10, and Haley has been taught evolution and science in school, and she finds it absolutely fascinating. However, her father is a famous creationist author and TV pundit and such, so he pulls her out of that school and sends her to a school that teaches creationism. Haley hates this and is constantly fighting against creationism the entire play. Robert, her father, doesn't quite understand her, and like a lot of parents, just desperately wants his daughter to believe and understand what he feels is right. So, let's go over some of the talking points of each side here. So I think a great example of this debate is the actual debate that NPR sponsored between Bill Nye and Ken Ham a little while back. Bill Nye obviously was on the side of evolution, and Ken Ham was for creationism. Just in case you don't know who either of these men are, Bill Nye is an American scientist, most well known for his children's program where he taught science. And Ken Ham is a best-selling Christian author. Ham, a true creationist, believes that the Earth is only about 6,000 years old and that it's only been about 4,000 years since the Great Flood of Noah. Creationists used the Bible's chronology to calculate this number. Nye, who believes in evolution, believes that the Earth is billions of years old. Both cited what they viewed as supporting details to their respective beliefs, so here are some of them. Bill Nye cited multiple instances of fossils appearing in fairly distinct layers by era, none mingling at all. This supports that the Earth is over the 6,000-year age that Ham quotes. He also discusses snow and ice layers found in the Arctic that are so deep they would take 680,000 winter-summer cycles to form, which is longer than that 4,000 to 6,000-year range. There's also no evidence, Nye stated, of an epic flood like the one in the Bible, which Ham and most creationists believe actually happened. Nye discusses more about fossil layers, canyons, and other evidence that a worldwide flood such as that could not have occurred. He also points to the stars, saying that there are too many to have arrived in just the past 4,000 to 6,000 years. Now, let's look at Ham's points. So he starts out by referencing other scientists, prominent ones, that have been creationists. And those people do exist. He also said that his views conformed with Darwin's, but that the word evolution has been hijacked to mean something that it doesn't. He cites a textbook from the 1900s that incorrectly discusses Darwin's theories, which was the basis for the Scopes trial. He also then, at least if the transcript I'm reading is right, he reveals himself to be a flat earther, which I will not discuss that any further as I'm having enough trouble staying unbiased as it is. Anyways, Ham's rebuttal to Nye's points about fossil layers and such was that dating methods give, quote, all sorts of dates, implying that they are not always accurate. Ham has no real rebuttals for the point about stars and light that Nye brought up, just saying, quote, everyone has a problem concerning the light issue. Honestly, it would take me a bit too long to summarize the whole debate, so I highly recommend searching for it and reading or watching it for yourself. I found it incredibly interesting, if not a little bit infuriating. Ooh, okay, so thank God the unbiased part is over. If you can't tell, creationism is basically on par with flat earthers, in my opinion. Apparently, sometimes they're the same people. Believe what you want, it's your life. But if you believe those things, you're probably listening to the wrong podcast, because we believe in science here. So, just saying. Okay, and with that, it's time to get into our reading portion. We have Lily Welsh back to read a monologue as Haley. But first, a word from our sponsor. And now, Lily Welsh performing a monologue as Haley.
Dear Galileo, it's me again. Miss Hunt told us you were going to come to class next week for National Science Month to answer our questions. But I guess you probably know I'm not going to be there, which is stupid. I know it's not like I was really going to meet you. I'm pretty sure it's just going to be Miss Hunt's boyfriend that wants to be an actor, dressed up in a costume. She made us go see him in that awful play where they were all singing trains, and he's not very good. But anyway, it can't be you. You're dead. And dead people don't come back. I mean, there's heaven and stuff, but that's different. Daddy says it's not, but it is. He's always like, you have a mother too, in heaven, but that's not the same as if she were here. Miss Hunt said you had a daughter of your own. She probably got to do science things all the time. Ugh, she's so lucky. I don't want to go to this stupid new homeschooling lady. Dad says everyone at the Young Earth Institute is always talking about how amazing Miss Callahan's program is. But I don't know what they're talking about. All those kids do is color and read boring poems about Jesus. Miss Hunt was going to teach us about the oceans next month. I wanted to learn about the oceans.
Thank you so much, Lily, for that amazing performance. If anyone would like to contact Lily with professional inquiries, her contact information is in the show notes of this episode. All right, so we have arrived at the discussion section. So I want to start off talking about form because I think it's really important to this show. So this show has three timelines happening at the exact same time. We have Galileo and Celeste in Renaissance Italy. We have Robert and Haley in the early 2000s. And then smack in the middle there, well, not really, but in the middle, we have Cassie Willows and Gabriel, who are at the VAT telescope in Arizona in like the 90s. But all these stories have similar themes or like similar relationships involved. So there's a father-daughter relationship in every single story, even though we don't see Cassie and her father Jasper interact until the end of the show. We have the Celeste and Galileo relationship. We also have the Haley and Robert relationship. And so we do have the Cassie-Jasper relationship. It's just that Jasper is absent from that relationship until like the end of the play. We only see Jasper as the narrator character until then. There's also astronomy and science being talked about in every single story. We have Galileo writing his last book. We have the VAT telescope, which obviously lots of astrophysics and astronomy stuff there. And we also have the debate basically between Haley and her father about creationism versus evolution. And that is obviously heavily science-based. There's a lot of emotion versus logic happening. Because, I mean, we as humans, if you haven't figured it out already during this little pandemic that we're having, people can convince themselves of a lot of things, especially when they have strong emotions regarding them. And we do see that a lot in this play. And we also see people try and think differently, especially by the end of the play. But also, the most important part of this, I think, is this interconnectedness of all living beings, both currently alive and not. In the end of the play, I will try not to spoil it too much, but at the end of the play, who am I kidding? I'm going to tell you. Everyone is connected. Surprise! I'll tell you how as we continue on in this section, but all the stories, every single person, we find out that they're all connected. Either through like blood or through situation, by circumstance, like they are all connected. And that is the part that makes me super emotional. So we will talk about that later. So let's start out with like the characters. So Jasper Willows, the famed astrophysicist, kind of like Stephen Hawking-y kind of guy. He is the narrator character and Cassie's father. He doesn't step into the play, like I said, until the end. And we find out why. That I will try and keep a secret. We'll see. But he doesn't step into the story until the end. He is just kind of an outside observer, narrating, telling us about different astrophysics sort of concepts and comparing them to life and to what's happening. He's basically only talked about by the other characters, and he's very separate from them until the end. But he does give us context, and in a way, he is what connects all the characters together by the end, because, I guess I'll say it now, Cassie is his kid, obviously, and Haley is his bio-grandkid, because Cassie is pregnant, and she's giving the child up for adoption. Robert and his wife adopt her. So, there's that. And then Gabriel is Jasper's assistant. Galileo and Celeste are the Willows' is great times whatever grandparents, separated by one great, because they are descended directly from Celeste. So yeah. Jasper is very cerebral, but I am too. So I loved his science monologues that rambled about how science and spirituality can be essentially the same thing sometimes. And some might find him a little long-winded, I will say that. But I think the right actor could totally pull it off. And I think his monologues were beautiful. Honestly, if I had had an older male actor to jump on and be like, hey, do this monologue for the podcast, I probably would have had one of his monologues be read. But I thought Haley was a good was a good substitute because she's an amazing character. I'll get to her in a little bit. So let's go, since we were just talking about Jasper, let's talk about his daughter and his assistant. So Cassie is, like I said, his pregnant daughter, who is a sculptor in New York. She's been brought to the telescope to try and help them, like, track down her dad or, like, try and get him to come out of wherever the heck he is. They thought, oh, if he sees his daughter is here, maybe he'll come back. Yeah, spoiler alert. He doesn't. So Gabriel, who is Jasper's assistant, kind of has to step in and start being in charge. And since Cassie was her dad's first assistant, she's able to assist him pretty well. And a little kind of thing develops, which is, you know, pretty forbidden, because, surprise, not really. Gabriel is a Catholic priest on top of being an astrophysicist, which, like I said earlier, the Vatican Observatory employs Jesuits, i.e. like priests and nuns and stuff. So, yeah, it's a little forbidden. Cassie's kind of having her, like, Fleabag season 2 moment. But I think a lot of people probably find that tension kind of interesting and intriguing and maybe even a little sexy. Sure, I'm not gonna judge you. But basically, yeah, it's a romance between this secretly famous under a pseudonym Banksy-type artist, who's the daughter of a famous astrophysicist, and a Catholic priest who is also an astrophysicist. So, what is the purpose of this little fling, you might ask? Especially because it is, you know, not allowed in Catholicism for priests to, you know, mingle with people they're sexually attracted to, kind of thing, you know. Well, this little fling reminds them both of what they actually, like, want and need in their lives. So Cassie needs to not be afraid to claim her art and put her true artistic self out there. And Gabriel needs to be reminded of what he values and why he chose to be both a priest and a scientist in the first place. So basically everything for most characters in this play can be analyzed to be about identity, which, from reading the summary, which I assume was crafted by the playwright, seems pretty intentional. So this fling, while forbidden, helps these characters to discover or remember what's truly important. So now, Haley and Robert, because, Haley, I love her. She's a beautiful child, chef's kiss, great kid. She's a child who thinks critically and wants to learn. And I think adults forget that actually most kids are like this before the American school system and or sometimes their families beat it out of them. She doesn't just accept what her father or her teachers tell her is right. She compares it to other things she has learned and makes her own decisions. And she decides that she believes what Miss Hunt, her old teacher, who is played by the same actor as Celeste in a scene or two, has taught her. And in the end, her father, Robert, is reminded of how he used to love hanging around people different than him, how even his own wife held extremely different beliefs from his. She was a science teacher, and as Miss Hunt reminds him, in college, a bisexual with purple hair, which I was, you know, kind of cheering off the sidelines about that, because, like, same. So, yeah, he's reminded that, like, wait, I used to really value being around people who did not think the same way as I thought. And so he and his daughter end up kind of writing a book together about their journey of communication and learning about each other and how they've, you know, come to respect or at least better understand each other's beliefs. And I think that's great, honestly. Instead of just having one of them convert, even though, again, like I said, creationism is some BS. I liked that. Like, he didn't automatically go like, oh, yes, of course, my 10-year-old daughter, she's totally right, and I'm going to abandon everything I've ever believed. Because that wouldn't make sense. He's like a 30, 40-something-year-old dude. And this is like his career. Why would he all of a sudden stop believing in it? So I liked that it just ended up they accepted each other. And he allows his daughter to believe whatever she wants because, surprise, children are people and you should let them do that. So I really loved the conclusion to their arc a lot. So now finally, the oldest pairing, the oldest timeline, Galileo and Celeste. So they are kind of a strange mirror of Haley and Robert, but also not at all. And also a strange mirror of Jasper and Cassie, but also not at all. All three father-daughter pairs have strained relationships, but for different reasons. So Galileo and Celeste clearly love each other very deeply. They care about each other a lot. However, Celeste resents him for essentially calling her home from the convent, in which she was very happy to be his caretaker. And she helps him to write his last book, which they do connect over, but then Celeste ends up pregnant to a Catholic priest, obviously out of wedlock, and this causes yet another rift. It is tumultuous. Their beliefs, wants, and needs sometimes get in the way of each other. But in the end, they try to do right by each other. Galileo supports Celeste through her pregnancy and helps her to essentially get like a fake ID and move to Holland, where she publishes his last book for him. And if we look at all these stories, that's what stands out. That through the ups and downs, in the end, these people just want to do their best to do right by each other. Everyone is connected. No man is an island. This play supports these statements in so many ways. It supports them scientifically, socially, and also weirdly, sorta, genetically. This idea is something that I am so, so passionate about, and I feel like if more people deeply believed this, we'd have a lot less problems in the world. What I do in my life affects so many other people. So many people that I may not even know all of them. Even a simple choice to, I don't know, bring your lunch to work instead of buying it changes something about someone's day, not just yours. I know for a lot of us it brings up like memes in High School Musical, but we really are all in this together. We're on the same ship, and together we will sink or float. I think nowadays that can be a really scary thought. At least here in America, like, we are so incredibly divided right now. And that's why I think this play is important. Why this play now? Because now more than ever, we need plays that remind us that we are not alone, that our actions have ripples and consequences, and that everything we do and are connects us to somebody else. We can no longer thrive on individualism. We're a community, damn it! And we'll all start doing a lot better if we start acting like it. Okay, rant over. That's where I think I'll end things for this episode. So thank you all so much for listening. If you'd like to contact the podcast to suggest plays and or guests that you might want to hear about, email me at theplaymatespodcast@gmail.com or fill out the Google form on our website. You can follow the podcast on Instagram at Playmates Podcast. That's at Playmates Podcast. You can also visit the link tree in the podcast Instagram bio to find our website, playmatespodcast.weebly.com, and to find my professional website, as well as how to support the podcast if you would like. Also, please take a second to write a good review and rate the podcast 5 stars on iTunes or Apple Podcasts if you can. It really means a lot. Also, follow on Spotify if you don't mind. That would also mean a lot, too. All right, so I can't wait to see you all in the next episode. I have a few people on the line for interviews, but, you know, December is very, very busy. So we will see who we can pull. Because all three of them would love to be on the podcast. We just need to figure out what order and who is actually available. So the next episode is a surprise, but it will be an interview with a playwright about their play. That I can tell you. So thanks again for listening. Have a safe and fulfilling week. Bye for now.